political system certainly has not transformed into a democracy, but I don't think it's the same as where it was when he took over either.
China marks 40 years of reform amid turbulent relations with the West. It's Wednesday, December 19th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, tech companies in the middle of trade and security concerns. Japan gets more defensive. Boeing flying high while Johnson & Johnson drops low. Recycling rather than flushing and saving Detroit homes. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Tuesday marked the 40th anniversary of China's reform and opening up, launched by the late leader Deng Xiaoping, that led to the country's explosive growth, making China the world's largest exporter, second largest economy at nearly $13 trillion, with the greatest number of billionaires. Speaking from the Great Hall of the People, Chinese President Xi Jinping, in a 90-minute speech, called for support of the state economy while encouraging and guiding the non-state economy. But he said there is no textbook of rules on reforms and the opening of China. He said no one is in a position to dictate to the Chinese people what should and should not be done. The anniversary comes amid a tariff war with the United States over a number of Chinese policies, including the communist government's strong support of its sprawling state sector and restrictions on foreign access. One Beijing-based political analyst told the French press agency trade tensions may represent an opportunity for China to enact more reforms. Philip Levy, a former Bush administration trade official and adjunct professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he actually thinks both China's economic and political systems have changed during this 40-year period.
I would say the political system certainly has not transformed into a democracy, but I don't think it's the same as where it was when he took over either. So I think you've seen dramatic changes as a result of this opening up.
What was Deng Xiaoping's original plan to transform the economy from this collectivization that seemed to not be going so well to what it is today?
You had had a couple of disastrous decades from the Great Leap Forward through the Cultural Revolution. And I think what Deng Xiaoping started was an experiment. It was finding a corner of the country and seeing whether that corner could try something new, a degree of capitalism, and see whether that might work. And it did. It worked very, very well. Part of the reason it worked well was that China found itself in a very good neighborhood where you had vibrant economies of Asia are all around it, and it was able to take bite-sized pieces of the economic activity and build from there.
You saw an analyst, China analyst, suggesting that with China's slowing economy, mounting debt, this might be a good opportunity for more reform. Do you think so?
I think China badly needs reform. I think you've seen some recent leaders, including Xi Jinping, step back from the kind of reforms we were seeing in the late 1990s. And so it very much needs it. And it does have some serious economic concerns, from a slowing economy to debt to demographics. The problem is that sometimes some of the actions the U.S. is taking can discredit reformers, because even though these are the things China should be doing anyways, it doesn't sound good if you're doing it under foreign threat.
What might the shape of those reforms look like in your view?
Oh, I think it's a bigger role for markets. It's reducing subsidies. It's diminishing the role of state-owned enterprises. And trying to sort of rationalize the banking system and the financial system. Those are big undertakings, and they have a lot of political implications, so it's not an easy thing to do.
China and the U.S. clashed in Geneva at the World Trade Organization on Monday over the vision of the direction of the WTO should be taking, the U.S. raising serious concerns about the functioning and direction of the WTO, saying it favors China. What say you?
There are some concerns about the WTO, and I think it is a challenge to deal with China. I think the right way to do that is to reach a new agreement. On balance, I think the WTO has been extraordinarily beneficial for the U.S., for Europe, and for China as well. And so the idea that it's been imperfect and therefore we should destroy it is foolish.
What direction does this trade spat between the two countries take, in your view?
I think they're going to have a very hard time meeting the 90-day deadline to wrap things up by early March, partly because the White House has said they don't want quick, shallow solutions or promises. They want deep-seated reforms, and those just don't tend to happen that quickly. So I have a feeling it's going to get worse before it gets better.
In his speech, President Xi said China will never pursue development at the cost of others, nor will China give up its legitimate rights and interests. He said China's development poses no threat to any country, and it will never seek homogeny. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you go to voanews.com. President Moon outlines South Korean economic plan as think tanks point to continued slowing. China's Xi calls for reform implementation, offers no new measures. Japan to buy more stealth jets, radar to counter China and Russia. Vietnam natural gas plans clash with climate fears. UN condemns North Korean rights violations and nuclear spending. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found when you go to our VOA Asia Facebook page and stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. American tech companies have long looked to China as a key partner to help build and sell cutting-edge devices and services. But now tensions are rising high between Washington and Beijing, and Silicon Valley may be caught in the middle. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
In recent years, Silicon Valley and China have strengthened their bonds with investment, trade, and partnerships. But that openness might be changing. U.S. complaints that China engages in unfair trading practices has created a growing rift. And the detention of a Chinese smartphone executive in Canada over allegedly breaking U.S. sanctions on Iran has made tech executives feel vulnerable.
All of these people are worried if they travel back and forth, they might be arrested because of the IP, something they know and they talk about in both China or in the USA.
The issues have been building for years. Even as Chinese companies and investors set up shop in Silicon Valley, American tech executives have been complaining about intellectual property theft and an uneven playing field when doing business in China, something President Trump has hit hard.
The relationship really isn't as reciprocal as it needs to be. The extraction of technologies involuntarily from foreign companies to accelerate China's technology leadership.
Chinese money that has helped fuel the current boom in Silicon Valley may start drying up. One reason, a new U.S. law beefs up oversight of foreign investment and technology acquisitions that are strategically important.
The main worry, I think, is more about lack of Chinese investors, investment coming to support Silicon Valley technology development.
Lawmakers are concerned that U.S. tech companies, as they pursue the Chinese market or seek Chinese investment, might lose core technology to the Chinese government, a competitor and sometime adversary on the global stage. For U.S. entrepreneurs, the changing climate may mean they will have to become more cautious.
You want to do business in China. If you are doing consumer products, I say that's probably fine, but let's presume you're doing AI. I say, you better find out exactly what you're doing.
If tensions between Washington and Beijing escalate, the very openness of Silicon Valley may be one casualty.
The political concerns, which are real, they're more focused and concentrated in Washington and in public policy. But inevitably, as we look into 2019 and after that, they're going to be intruding to some degree on this sort of open market, open platform philosophy.
Experts say that Silicon Valley could benefit if China becomes a more even playing field. But in the meantime, uncertainty reigns. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Happening now in Asia, two new Japanese government defense papers say Japan will accelerate spending on advanced stealth fighters, long-range missiles, and other equipment over the next 5 years to support U.S. forces facing China's military in Western Pacific. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. The cabinet of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Tuesday approved a 5-year defense plan that will give the country its first post-war aircraft carrier, a refitted helicopter carrier, and large purchases of advanced U.S. weaponry, including dozens of the stealth F-35 warplanes at a cost of more than $240 billion. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said to respond to the changes in national security circumstances, effective defense capabilities need to be set up, and that's why it's necessary to boost the quality and quantity of those capabilities. The defense guidelines cite the need to counter challenges from North Korea, China, and Russia. But Japan Forum for Strategic Studies senior research fellow Grant Newsham said all the prime minister is doing is reversing years of decelerating defense spending. He said the country continues to refuse to properly fund defense.
I know the press gives a lot of coverage about Abe's increases in defense spending, but keep in mind that when Abe took office, defense budgets had reduced every year for a decade. He has only been managed to really eke out small incremental increases since he's been in office. As a result, Japan says it's going to do a lot more in the region. It's going to buy 140-plus F-35s. It's building more submarines and ships. But it's not really increasing spending enough to pay for it. So it's effectively going to have to cannibalize an already too small budget.
Is Japan a regional power?
Yes. It's steadily losing ground, however, to China. When Japan is properly linked in with the United States and works seamlessly with U.S. forces, then that is a formidable force. By itself, Japan has some real shortcomings with its defense, particularly the three Japanese services really cannot cooperate with each other. This is an immense problem. Japan's defense really isn't even the sum of its parts. It has some very good niche capabilities, its submarine force, its anti-submarine warfare capabilities, its Navy's excellent. There's good quality in both the Air Self-Defense Force and the Japanese Army. But once again, these services do not cooperate with each other and cannot do anything but the most rudimentary joint operations.
This report came out as Russia announced it was building new barracks for troops on a northern island captured from Japan at the end of the Second World War.
This has been a problem for really since the end of the war. Mr. Abe takes his inability to get these islands back personally. It really obsesses him. I think we'll be talking about this 20 years from now. I don't expect the Russians to give back any of those islands. They may allow some partial Japanese presence, for really an economic presence. It's just hard to see them returning these four islands. But they're glad to string the Japanese along and see what they can squeeze out of them financially. But I think Mr. Abe's certainly an ardent suitor, but I don't think it's going to pay off. And I don't see any successors are really pushing the issue the way he does.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman said what Japan is doing is neither conducive to improving bilateral relations nor to the broader picture of regional peace and stability. Coming up, two different fortunes for two well-known companies. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, an Indonesian woman due to begin her defense next month in her trial for the murder in Malaysia of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's half-brother, suffered a setback when a judge rejected her bid to secure statements given to police by 7 witnesses. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features you can see and share them. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Boeing sees blue skies in China, while a traditional personal products manufacturer comes under fire. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Boeing has opened its first 737 completion plant in China and delivered its first plane, built for Air China. According to Boeing President and CEO Kevin McAllister, there will be more to come.
Clearly, China has and will continue to play a key in Boeing's success. We share a long, successful history of cooperation and strong partnership together, and we look forward to this continuing partnership for many years to come.
Boeing invested $33 million last year to take a majority stake in a joint venture with state-owned Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, or COMAC, to build the completion center. The strategic investment on Boeing's part is aimed at building a sales lead over arch-rival Airbus. Both companies have been expanding their footprint in the fast-growing Chinese market. Xiaoyi Rong is the vice president of Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China.
China has a big appetite for aircrafts. The next 20 years is an important period of strategy and opportunity for the aviation industry. We, as well as Boeing Company, will focus on providing a safer, more economic, more environmental, more comfortable transportation for the aviation market and human beings.
The aviation market in China is expected to overtake the United States as the world's largest in the next decade. Shares of Johnson & Johnson have fallen nearly 13% since last week, their biggest percentage drop in more than 16 years. The drop came after a Reuters report was released that claimed the company knew about the presence of asbestos in its talcum powder as early as 1971. Johnson & Johnson had assured the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that no asbestos was detected in any sample of talc produced between December 1972 and October 1973. It was later revealed that at least three tests by three different labs from 1972 to 1975 had found asbestos in its talc. In a statement posted to their website, Johnson & Johnson said their baby powder was safe and asbestos-free, and that studies conducted on over 100,000 men and women showed that talc does not cause cancer or asbestos-related disease. The company also called the Reuters report one-sided, false, and inflammatory. Talc powder products contributed to 0.5% of Johnson & Johnson's revenue of $76.5 billion last year, but the baby powder product is considered essential to the company's image. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. The UN General Assembly has condemned North Korea's systematic, widespread, and gross violations of human rights and its diversion of resources into pursuing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles over the welfare of its people. It noted with concern that over 10 million North Koreans are estimated to be undernourished. You'll find more on VOA Asia Facebook. Now in VOA Asia, fertilizer is made of nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus. Chemical fertilizers require huge amounts of energy to produce, but there are other natural, more readily available sources. A project at the University of Michigan, conducted with support from the National Science Foundation, is aimed at making our water cleaner, our agriculture more sustainable by capturing one of those sources rather than flushing it down the toilet. VOA's Faith Lapidus explains.
The nonprofit Rich Earth Institute is working with environmental engineer Nancy Love and her team. With support from the National Science Foundation, they are fine-tuning new methods to recycle urine into fertilizer. The nonprofit Rich Earth Institute is working with Love and her team. Abraham Nohayes says they're fine-tuning new methods to recycle urine into fertilizer.
There's a great quote by Buckminster Fuller about how pollution is nothing but the resources that we're not harvesting, and that we allow them to disperse because we've been ignorant to their value.
Harvesting the resource of urine, which is, after all, full of the same ingredients as chemical fertilizer, will fix two problems at once: eliminate waste and create a natural fertilizer. Kim Nace says they collect about 26,000 liters a year, thanks to a loyal group of dedicated donors.
We now have people who have some source separating toilets in their homes. We also have people who have 55-gallon barrels where they collect and then we transport to our farms.
They pasteurize the urine to kill any microbes, and then it's applied directly onto hayfields. Now that they've partnered with the University of Michigan, Love says they're looking to go to the next level.
There are three things we really are trying to do with the urine in this kind of next phase. We're trying to concentrate it, we're trying to apply technologies to reduce odor, and we're trying to deal with the trace contaminants like the pharmaceuticals.
Dealing with pharmaceuticals is an important issue. Heating up urine kills germs, but has no effect on chemicals like drugs that pass through our bodies.
We know pharmaceuticals are a problem for aquatic organisms and water systems.
For Love, this is all about redesigning our wastewater infrastructure for the 21st century. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Nicole Curtis is all about before and after. She purchases abandoned and broken down buildings and renovates them, giving them a new life. Anusha Vitsian met with Nicole Curtis and learned how this single mom turned into a TV star and a godmother for Detroit's many collapsing houses.
There are thousands of abandoned empty houses in Detroit. In some neighborhoods, whole blocks look lifeless, houses standing without windows and doors. Local authorities plan to tear down all buildings that are beyond repair. The rest will be auctioned off. If no one is interested, they will be demolished as well. There is, however, at least one person interested in these dilapidated houses. Her name is Nicole Curtis, and she buys buildings that are most likely to be torn down to give them a new look and a new life.
Good morning, how are you? The background for it. And I was like, okay, what do I do now? And so I did, I hired myself, and I put an ad on Craigslist and said, basically, if you let me design your house and let me take photos of it, then I'll do it for free.
There are numerous houses along the street that are still standing thanks only to Curtis. Nicole, who trained as a teacher, but decided she preferred power drills to crayons. What started as a hobby for the single mom has turned into a multi-million business with a reach far beyond Detroit. Today, Curtis is the host of Rehab Addict, a mega-hit TV show on HDTV and DIY Network. The half-hour show, which premiered in 2010, is dedicated to saving houses and giving them a second chance.
There we go.
It is not an inexpensive endeavor. Curtis bought this century-old house for $17,000. In order to fully renovate it, she plans on investing another $400,000.
And obviously, this is a mess. I mean, we don't even have a floor over in this part.
All the houses Curtis works on start out in a very sad state, but she knows each of them is a diamond in the rough.
Well, I think with this one, even with it in this shape, I can see the grandness. I can see the shadows of the casing that used to be here. And, you know, I see a bit of a fireplace and I see the plaster falling off the walls. So the way I walk through a house is I see it completely finished, where everyone else sees it as broken glass, broken plaster, warped floors, no floor.
However, nothing about Detroit real estate and renovation is easy and predictable. Buying a house, something accepted as a safe and reliable investment, remains a big risk here.
The chances of this one getting burned down tonight are really great.
Curtis's recipe for success is simple. Work hard and be ready to take a risk.
You want to do it?
Yeah.
All right. So, and you never want to put the gun towards your face. Okay.
But most importantly, Curtis says one needs to learn to see the beauty in old houses, which will repay this trust in full by becoming the best homes. Anusha Vitisyan, VOA News, Detroit, Michigan.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Of course, you'll find us on VOA Asia Facebook as we stream our program every day right there, as well as on our website, voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you. You can write to us. Our email is voaasia@voanews.com. You can also send us a message on VOA Asia Facebook if you like. We'd also like to say hello to everyone who's listening on the radio. Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore carries our program. Thanks for tuning in today. Our thanks go out to Director Tracy Carter and Engineer John Ellison, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.